Malvolio in San Francisco. 2 days ago, they were playing the piano with a hammer and a blowtorch. Next week, they will read poetry to saxophones. And always they are building the Chinese wall of laughter. They laugh so much more than I do, and it doesn't wear them out as it wears me out. That's why your poetry's no good, they say. You should turn yourself upside down so your ass would stick out, they say, and they seem to know. They are right, of course. I do feel awkward playing the game. I do play the clown badly. I cannot touch easily. But I mistrust the ways of this city. With its white skies and weak trees, one finds no impala here. And the birds are pigeons. The first rate seems unknown in this city of easy fame. The hand's skill is always from deliberate labor. They put Phidias in prison about his work on the Parthenon, saying he had stolen gold, and he probably had. Those who didn't try to body Athena, they stayed free. And Orpheus probably invited the rending by his stubborn alien smell. Poor Orpheus, who lost so much by making the difficult journey when he might have grieved easily. Who tried to go back among the living with the smell of journey on him? Poor Orpheus, his stubborn tongue blindly singing all the way to Lesbos. What if I should go yellow-stockinged and cross-gartered? Suppose I smile, fantastically, kissed my hand to novelty. What then? Still would they imprison me in their dark house? Would they taunt me as doctors concerned for my health and laugh, always that consuming, unrelenting laughter? The musk deer is beguiled down from the great mountain by flutes to be fastened in a box and tortured for the smell of his pain. Yet somehow, there is somehow, I long for my old bigotry. That was the poem Malvolio in San Francisco by Jack Gilbert. This is Swan Drishti, and you are listening to Ink and Worm on Radio Free Brooklyn. Thank you for tuning in. I am incredibly excited about this week's guests and our eclectic conversation. I talked with Tom Zollner. Tom is the author of 5 nonfiction books, including Train. He is the co-author of the New York Times bestselling book, An Ordinary Man, and his book, Uranium, won the 2011 Science Writing Award from the American Institute of Physics. Tom has worked as a reporter for the San Francisco Chronicle and the Arizona Republic, and as a contributing editor for the Men's Health magazine. He is now an associate professor of English at Chapman University, and the politics editor at the Los Angeles Review of Books. Tom is a founding member of the journalism collective DECA, and a teacher in the Op-Ed Project. Tom has received residencies from the Mesa Refuge, the Malay Colony for the Arts, the Corporation at Yaddo, and the Lannan Foundation Residency Fellowship. He lives in Los Angeles. I was a little intimidated, you can probably tell by the interview, but some great conversation happened, so I hope you enjoy the conversation. And I wonder how many times I can say conversation. I think just 3. I think that's the limit. Also, if you'd like to find out more about Tom, he's definitely got an internet presence, and you can start at his website, tomzollner.com, TOMZOELLNER.com. Thank you, and enjoy this interview with Tom on Radio Free Brooklyn, Ink and Worm.
here with Tom Zollner. It's a pleasure to be here with you. And you are a journalist. Initially, it sounded like, from looking on Wikipedia, you've always been writing articles and journalism.
Yes,
type stuff.
I started as a newspaper reporter on a small paper in Nebraska, and then onward to a paper in Wyoming, in South Georgia, in Salt Lake City, Utah, San Francisco, and then finally in Phoenix.
So you've been all over.
Yeah, not as much as the U.S. as I wanted to see, but, you know, a good portion of it.
So making your way around. And then also an author of 5 books, is that accurate?
Uh-huh, yeah, I got lucky.
Got lucky?
Yeah.
What do you mean?
It's, I think, a dream of many reporters to sit down and write a book, and I never did when I was a reporter, but when my journalism career ended, you know, I had the time and the freedom to sit down and try that, and I got lucky. I got one published.
Thanks for giving context to that. That's really great. I forgot what I was going to say, but let's move into Arizona. Did you grow up in Arizona?
More or less, yeah. Born in Colorado, but grew up in Phoenix and Tucson.
So a lot of influence from the West. And then your first, was it your first book exploring a safe way in Arizona? Exploring?
No. The first book I wrote was about the diamond business.
Okay.
Yeah. A Safeway in Arizona is about a mass shooting in my hometown of Tucson. I knew two of the victims. And so that book, which was written very quickly in the space of only 100 days, was an attempt to make sense of that.
It's kind of like a processing
thing. No, it wasn't about me. I wasn't trying to process it necessarily for myself, although certainly that was going on at the time. It was more trying to explain the hidden factors behind the event.
Mm. That seems like that is a theme in your books, at least, of looking at something that people just see or don't see, and then really diving into it and all the different facets. You did that with diamonds. You did that with uranium. You did that with trains. And you did that with one person. You co-authored a book about Paul
Rusa Sabagina.
Yes.
Yeah, he's the hotelier whose story was featured in the movie Hotel Rwanda. So, you know, the movie was a very good movie, but there's a deeper story there, too. And that's, you know, really the case with any nonfiction as it seeks to look closer. No one's ever going to get the 100% complete answer about anything in this world. I'm convinced that that will forever elude us. But what we can do is look closer and try and see things from different angles.
So I'm curious, it seems like this has definitely become your approach to writing. Is that how it's always been for you? You always just see something, you're curious about it, you research, you write about it? Is that, or is how did this start?
Yeah, I mean, the number one thing that a newspaper reporter is supposed to do is go find stuff out, you know, tell the public what's going on, try and do it with care and with accuracy and with curiosity and when warranted, some aggression. But that's really the job.
Which is why journalists sometimes get a bad rap.
Yeah, I mean, mostly undeserved in my point of view. I mean, oftentimes when, you know, tough questions are asked, it's to people who really need to answer those questions, namely public officials, people who presume to stand before us and take our tax money and set policy for us. I mean, they should be questioned, and if you want to be a politician, you should have a thick skin. That said, I'm not one who thinks politician should be this, like, pejorative, this negative word. You know, we sort of put it in the same category as bureaucrat, you know, something to be despised. You know, we hate our politicians because they disappoint us, because they say one thing and do another. I mean, that's sort of part of the discontent in our nation right now. But I actually have a lot of admiration for those elected leaders who are able to balance competing interests and, you know, try to make most sides happy. That's what you have to do in a heterodox society. And so the polity that lies at the root of that word, I hope that we can rediscover it. And I hope that, you know, when we think about our elected leaders, we also think about their need to forge compromises. And therefore, I don't consider politician a dirty word.
Thank you. I really appreciate you saying that. I want to rewind just a little bit, and I'm curious about your personal trajectory. What put you on this path to becoming a journalist? Can you remember?
I just remember being fascinated with the daily newspaper. My parents subscribed. I mean, here it was. It was like this magic mirror to the rest of the world. You could open it up and see things that were happening in Yugoslavia. You know, it made the rest of the world sort of relevant, and that it could be contained in a small space and within words, you know, was kind of magical to me. And so, you know, we're born knowing how to tell stories. This is what we have to do to survive as sort of complex beings, is we just make sense of the stimuli that surrounds us as we go about our days. And, you know, the news is just an extension of that documentation process. And so it's a way of being curious about the world and a way to have that become a means of making a living and an identity.
Do you remember what newspaper your parents were subscribing to?
When I was a kid, it was the Denver Post, where we lived until I was the age of six. I was really too young to read it, but I was old enough to understand it. And then it was the Arizona Republic, which is the...
So some more local newspapers that were high quality, it sounds like.
Yeah, this was the age, this was the 1970s and 80s, where, you know, big statewide newspapers really had a lot of ambition and authority. And it would later become a privilege of mine to go to work for the Arizona Republic, which was a newspaper I grew up reading as a kid. And that was a great treat. It was, at the time, going through the changes, the inexorable changes that all national newspapers were going through at the time, which is, you know, the challenges of the internet and the shrinking ad base, the loss of revenue, and the aging of the readership.
Well, and you hit your career and saw this process happening more. I'm curious about that because, how is this transition to digital, like, affecting journalism? I feel like, you know, newspaper consumption is on the decline and more people are just looking online. Is that accurate? And
the big failing of newspapers near the end of the century, which only a few realized at the time, was that the way to survive and thrive in an era where the platform is going to be different is to move to the platform, make the platform a work of quality. You know, not just bells and whistles and graphics, but something that would actually engage and intrigue readers, and to double down on the, you know, sort of intellectual quality of the content. Some papers did that better than others. Today, the New York Times and the Washington Post both have robust, app presences and web presences that do draw readers in. I worry about local newspapers, and I was sort of in the middle of this change, and when my job became less fun, and in fact not fun at all, in 2003, that's when I made the decision to leave.
Yeah, this question I hear a lot about. How do you either get or let people pay for content, and I lost my train of thought. Well, it's gone. Yeah, it's just this idea when there's so many quote-unquote places where someone would go for free, why would someone spend money on an app? But then it's like we need to value and therefore support, you know, accurate, good news reporting, good journalism.
I will say that one of the best times I had in the business was in your home state of Utah at the Salt Lake Tribune. Yeah. Our competition was owned by the LDS Church, the Deseret News. They're not quite the news organ that they used to be, but at the time they devoted a lot of resources to local coverage, and you know, it was always a sort of a thrill to beat them on something. And you know, Utah's a great news state. A lot happens there. It's you know, the church has an outside presence, and the church is a fascinating story. Although, mm-hmm. you know, certainly they work sometimes to make it as bland as possible, which is unfortunate, because there is a lot of texture and richness to LDS life, which, you know, I think doesn't really get the full appreciation that it deserves.
I'm getting the sense here, sitting with you, I caught you after teaching a class, which is what you're doing now, at least part-time.
Yes.
How has it been for you teaching? When did that start, and any, like, insights or changes in your perspective since?
Yeah, I took a university job in 2011, Chapman University in Orange County, California, and what made it possible was making the decision to come to Dartmouth College for graduate school, and in particular the Master of Arts in Liberal Studies program, which was good enough to invite me to come teach this summer, which has been a great privilege.
What I'm hearing too is, and I just finished reading a book, it's called If You Want to Write by Barbara or Brenda Euland. And she keeps tapping into this idea of storytelling, which is something you've mentioned a couple times in conversation, of just we're, you know, hardwired to tell stories, to either explain things or, you know, as cultures in Utah and religion, we have our stories that we tell and that we bring to the table. You're teaching creative writing now, mm-hmm. and so I'm curious about, how you approach that from a guidance standpoint, how you help people tell stories?
Yeah, writing is subjective. That there are not a lot of guideposts which are going to be absolute and that say tell a story this way and not that way. You know, there are certain elements in classic nonfiction that tend to work better than others, and we talk about those. But what I don't want to do is give mathematical formulas or to lay down unbendable principles of, you know, this is how you must tell the story. It's mm-hmm. I'm prepared to be surprised. That's part of how culture moves forward, is there's a rebellion against formal structures of doing things, and I don't want to necessarily squelch that in students. But I also want them to appreciate the tradition of what's come before them.
Mm-hmm. It's cliche, but it's accurate. If you want to write well, you have to read a lot, and you have to read a lot of, I would say, different kinds of writing to really have kind of points of reference. Something else I read from that same book I mentioned is the idea of writing something for someone, that this idea of audience is something I've been thinking about, because especially having a show, I think about the vast audience, and it becomes overwhelming. But when I think about one person, it becomes clear what I want to say, or, you know, what I want to create. And I think a similar thing can happen with writing. Is that a phenomenon you've experienced or you've heard of? Of just you think about writing something for one person. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Sure. I can recall an NPR producer telling me that one thing that she likes to do when she's writing out a feature story for the radio, she's got a picture of her mother tacked up on her cubicle, and she tries to tell the story just as if she was telling her mother in direct conversational terms. And so it can help to envision your audience, you know, to adjust your voice, to choose your words, to structure a story in a way that is aimed at just that one ideal listener. Mm-hmm. And hopefully that process will make your story more democratic.
Yeah, it seems like it's maybe a hack to kind of tap into your own voice and to keep your writing from being stale or just, you know, formulaic, as you will.
Yeah, the poet James Dickey had a saying. He said, quit trying so hard to say it and just say it, you know? Sometimes tight economical formulation of exactly what you're trying to get across, you know, can cut through any number of weeds.
I'm curious, I did see as I was researching that you've been to a number of residencies, writing residencies. Something I've never been, and I'm always so curious about, are these, I guess it's hard to generalize multiple experiences, but what was your relationship with writing residencies? Were you invited? Did you choose them?
Mm-hmm. Some of them you apply for. Others just kind of drop out of the sky. And yeah, it's a time apart from your work life. You don't have to worry about cooking. You know,
that's big.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, the whole day, if you're diligent, is dedicated to the project you're working on. And so, yeah, the work can be very intense, and you can, in a short period of time, 2 weeks or a month, get an astonishing amount of work done. And you ask yourself, why can't the rest of my life be this focused?
Are there specific books that you wrote while participating in the residencies?
About half of Uranium was written at the Mesa Refuge in Point Reyes Station, California. And, yeah, I've gotten long articles done at Yaddo.
Thanks. I do want to talk about Uranium. From your perspective, would it be fair to say that it's one of your more popular books?
I think it's the one that probably sold the most, yes.
Talk to me really quick about the dots for that book, how they connected, where the seed for the book happened, and where it developed.
Utah. I just left the Salt Lake Tribune and was on a kind of a road trip through southern Utah and was camping in a place near Goblin Valley State Park called Temple Mountain, and the sun was going down, and I saw up on the Mesa Tops, because this is that red rock country, that incomparable, mm-hmm. you know, sort of giant cityscape of stone in southern Utah. Up on the Mesa Tops were caves, but the caves looked kind of funny. They were square. They didn't look as though they were formed by wind or water. It looked sort of man-made, and I asked some folks camping nearby, what are those? And they said, those are uranium mines. They took uranium out of here to make atom bombs. And I was so fascinated with that fact, that this kind of phantasmagoric country of southern Utah had been rich in this mineral that was deadly and destructive and had done so much to rearrange the globe.
Mm.
You know, since the 1930s, that was a rabbit hole that I really wanted to go down.
And then you dove down. So camping to when you had the book accepted by a publisher, because the publishing process takes a long time too.
Right.
What kind of a timeline were we looking at?
Oh, that was quite a long timeline. I did a magazine story about it for this publication called American Heritage of Invention and Technology, you know, sort of a small magazine, but it was a thoroughly enjoyable experience. And that was in, gosh, I think 1999.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't until 2006, 2007, almost 7-8 years later, that the desire to turn that into a book really sort of blossomed.
So that was just for the... So you went down the rabbit hole during that time.
Yeah, and I thought it was over.
Researching.
Yeah, at that time. I mean, look, I'm from Tucson, Arizona. I mean, we don't write books in Tucson. You know, not because we're stupid, but just because, you know, the writing of a book just seems like, to me at the time, and to some degree still does, seem like this magical, exotic, you know, ambitious, almost pretentious thing that, you know, is out of the reach of ordinary people. I mean, that's what they do in New York City and Washington and mm-hmm. all these places that I never really got to go until I was an adult.
Mm-hmm. I like that, actually. It resonates with me of like this, you know, writing a book is something far beyond what I can do. I'll just keep writing whatever I write without, nobody needs to see it.
Yeah. In some ways, that's just realism at work. In other ways, we can self-sabotage ourselves by thinking too small. And I definitely was guilty of that for many years.
Combination of both. But Uranium did well. And I'm also curious about your book on trains. Where did that spark happen?
A sound. At the age of 8 years old, being taken to see my grandmother, who lived in a small Kansas town, and listening to the sound of a freight train out the window. You know, this was a town where the tracks were, you know, pretty much everyone in town could hear them, and her house was four blocks from the tracks. You know, trains were the sinews of a younger America. And I grew up far removed from them as a visible daily object or a sound, you know. That didn't happen in Tucson, Arizona, except if you were down near the tracks, which we were not.
Yeah.
Yeah, and so it was that sound of the whistle that that kind of got me.
Wanted to know more.
If you're just tuning in, this is Ink and Worm on Radio Free Brooklyn. Quick reminder, if you like the programs you hear, take a moment to check us out. We have a great community in Brooklyn. You can join us, see us at events, and also consider becoming a donor somehow. You know, even $1 a month, that's $12 a year. That's less than lunch, and it really does make a big difference. Thank you for listening, and I hope you enjoy the rest of my conversation with Tom Zollner.
Cuba, never mind.
Okay. But as far as you know, issues that that impassion me, I'm horrified by this presidency. I'm horrified by the way that the concept of truth has taken a beating in the popular imagination, the level of distrust given to legacy media is incredibly discouraging given all the journalists that I've known, knowing how hard they work to get it right, and to sort of see how little people know about that process and how quick they are to crap all over it is infuriating. The level of, not to turn this into a rant, but I do worry about lasting damage to the institution of the presidency, as well as trust in our leaders. I don't see this presidency ending well, and it makes me feel both angry and helpless, because I don't know what to do about it, except to keep writing, to vote, to not cut off people in my life who are fans of this president.
I guess he must have fans somewhere.
Yeah, 25% of the public. And, you know, I'm friends with some of them. I mean, a tiny fraction, obviously, but, you know, mainly folks that I know from my home state of Arizona, but also from elsewhere, and who seem to kind of go for this kind of authoritarian discourse.
Yeah, as you were speaking, it all felt so real. That's the... I have the same, I mean, and maybe on a smaller scale, of like, I really am overwhelmed, and I want to do something, and I don't know what to do, but I really am scared of the state of affairs as they stand and where it looks like they're heading, if you will. Let's look at my list. You also, I checked out your most recent things. You most recently did an an interview with Madeline Brand talking about Orange County mm-hmm. and oranges. What's the relationship there for you?
My college that I teach at full time yes. is in the city of Orange in Orange County, and there's a agricultural heritage that goes back to the 1890s and began to crumble in the early 60s, and so the ghosts of the citrus trees cast a long shadow, even though almost none of them are left.
Yes, well, and yeah, that's something you addressed in the interview, just this kind of, I wouldn't say fortunate, but this very just like specific turn of events that led to the land losing value, oranges trees not growing and dying, and then people wanting land. Mm-hmm. At the same time, just created this scenario for massive, I can't remember the word you used, but just this transformation. Yes, I should have written it down.
Many places go through this. The state of Vermont was at one time almost completely bare of forests in the early part of the 20th century when,
really?
When sheep were the big economic engine. And you can look at photographs of landscape that is now completely covered with trees, which was totally bald back in the 1910s and 20s. So certainly it's not the first place in the United States to go through radical changes in the landscape, and you know, a number of locales have experienced this and will continue to experience this.
You're like a walking encyclopedia. Is there anything you don't know about?
Oh, tons. tons. I mean, more than tons. Yeah. That's one of the frustrating parts of being alive, is the awareness that you're only gonna know just the micrograms out mm-hmm. out of the you know, metric tons that this universe has to offer.
Well, you're very good at holding the micrograms that you hold, and that's just to flatter you a little bit. Listening to your other interview, and I'm getting the same sense sitting here. I imagine you. Well, you speak like a book. I don't know how to say it in a different way. It's just. Your phrasing is very well put together, and your thoughts are easy to follow. So,
that's a very nice thing to say. Thank you.
I imagine your books are very readable, just from having listened to you and having talked to you.
Yeah, sometimes I wonder, but thank you. That's a nice thing to say.
Somebody's reading them, assuredly. You do need to go soon. How are we on time?
Doing great. If you want to start the roundup into the rapid fire.
Yeah, let's talk about that. First question I have for you is, in your editing process, who's the first person who sees your work? Is it different?
Yeah, it's different. If it's an article, it's going to be the article editor. If it's a book, it's going to be, obviously, the book editor. And then, the next person is going to be, in some cases, an editorial board. You know, usually the last person is the copy editor.
So for you don't have like a friend or family member that you throw things out to?
No, that would be a very rude thing to do.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I'm curious, in this day and age, how you listen to your music.
Oh, wow. I have some music loaded on an iPhone, but I still will turn on the FM radio in the car.
Oh, you're a radio person.
Yes.
Makes sense. I'm not surprised. I feel like from talking to people that there is a book they read during adolescence that changed them, or that really just affected them and something. Do you recall anything like that?
Wow. That wasn't necessarily, not one, you know, hinge book is coming to mind. I was, of course, fascinated with Holden Caulfield in The Catcher in the Rye. I was a voracious reader of the daily newspaper. I think that influenced me more than anyone totem. Let me think on this. Narrative I learned from Tale of Two Cities by Charles Dickens. Yeah, even though I was fully aware at the time that I could never ever write like that.
It's intimidating, I guess.
Very intimidating.
And a quick plug, if you missed the story at the beginning of the show, that you talk about newspapers and very charming influence in your career path. Do you have any routines with writing that you have to hold?
that's a good question. None that are very interesting.
But you laughed.
I can think of two that are fairly common and which I certainly want to recommend if you get stuck, any listeners. Beginnings are awfully hard, you know, like setting that voice, mm-hmm. figuring out what the first sentence is, how to take care of that really important territory at the front part of the piece. Sometimes it helps just to write quotidian sentences in the middle, you know, just sort of do some of the boring kind of informational work in the middle of the piece, and, you know, before long you're actually writing. Mm-hmm. And then also, if it's a long project, I like to stop knowing what the first sentences are going to be that I write the next day, and then not write them, and then come on in and then write them in the morning, and then, you know, that's a good way to get a cold start.
Who else was it? Was it
Hemingway? That's a Hemingway trick.
That,
yeah.
He would just stop in the middle so that you have. It's nice to go to the table knowing at least what
you're
going to do next.
Yeah.
That's great, thank you. If I were to come into your home, what books would be showcased on a coffee table or?
Yeah, that's interesting. I'm living temporarily in Norwich, Vermont, while I teach here at Dartmouth, and so it's really quite bare bones over there. What you'd see is a copy of Esquire magazine, a copy of Men's Health magazine on the dining table. You'd see a manuscript of a French short story collection that I'm reading, and a book of poetry from the 1920s from New Hampshire that was given to me as a gift. And let's see, you'd see a book or three about Jamaica and slavery. And I think that's all you would see, actually.
You have a home back home? Or you?
Yeah, most of my books are actually in my office at campus, and so you'd see a collection of novels. You'd see books about the creation of nonfiction, mm-hmm. and kind of a random assortment of stuff. There's no rhyme or reason to it. I'm not much of a bibliophile either. You know, I don't really believe in books as sacred objects. You know, they're tools. One or two might have sentimental value, but for the most part, you know, they are meant to be read and then passed on.
I like that. That's kind of a perspective I hold, but we have a really nice library here with a lot of old books that also have interesting histories. So it does, for me, that was the moment where I was like, okay, I understand, like, wanting to keep texts and keep them pristine and whatnot. What is the best writing advice you were given?
Best writing advice that I was given? Keep your butt in the chair.
How do you do this?
Yeah. But it's very easy to get frustrated, to get up to find some other task, but, you know, you really have to force yourself to do it. Write every day, and then I like to, when a project's going on, aim for 1,000 words a day. That comes via Carolyn C.
Maybe. I imagine having a box you can check off, because writing is kind of it's hard to measure if you're doing okay or not. So at least you've got your words.
Yeah. That also giving yourself the permission to be just mediocre. It's so hard to strive for greatness with every sentence, and it's just not going to happen. Yeah. Your reader just wants to hear a story, and I think that's the primary job in front of you is first and foremost, just tell a story.
Great. What is the best book you've disagreed with?
Oh, wow. What a question. Best book that I'm going to, before I leave, I will have you an answer, but I'm going to ponder that one.
A pass or a pause?
Yeah.
Well,
actually, wait. No, let me take that one on right now.
Perfect.
I find Christopher Hitchens infuriating, although he's an amazing writer. He comes to many glib and uninformed conclusions about the nature of religious faith while I think missing its essence. He knocks down its structures without taking on the center of it. And so while I disagree with him, I also have great respect for his talents as a stylist.
Fair. I haven't read anything by him, so maybe I won't be biased if I ever do. Do you have any streaming addictions, podcasts, or Netflix?
I loved Crime Town and listened to that on the way out here. And the one podcast I keep coming back to is Fresh Air, actually. I think Terry Gross is a genius.
Yes, that's on my list of my podcast playlist. Let's see if we can sneak some more in here. Is there a book that you've been recommending or gifting lately?
Not really. I tend to be pretty parsimonious with book recommendations out of nowhere. You know, it sort of has to be specific. If someone will mention something that occurs, I'll say, oh, you need to read or you should read X. But as insofar as like random book recommendations, no.
Yeah, it's often contextual, but sometimes...
For sure.
There's like, oh, the latest find in terms of what you're reading. Let's go with the last question. Do you have any kind of a cross training with your writing? Something that you do to kind of get ideas flowing or to take a break?
The only cure that I've ever found is a good long walk. That will often put you into a spell of semi-consciousness, where you're not thinking about it so much, where you're just sort of letting your subconscious talk to you, and then you tend to feel it more than you think it. Mm-hmm. And it's sometimes the feeling of something and the trying to express the feeling, which is where the magic lies.
It reminds me of a couple of things, but just relaxing. I can't recall... I don't want to throw out the wrong name. So, a great man in history. I have too many names coming to my mind, but he would doze with keys in his hand so that when he, like, dozed off, the keys would fall, he'd snap awake and, like, catch that thought that was coming while he was in this transitory state. So, relaxing, I think, sometimes is just, like, and like you said, just giving yourself permission to write mediocre things or even bad things, I think. Just like relax about the process and then suddenly it becomes easier.
Yeah, yeah. A phrase I like is, you know, good enough for government. And anyone who's worked as a newspaper reporter will know that, you know, you can't wait for, you know, the magical muse to come down and bless you on deadline. You know, either you do it or you don't have a job. And so therefore you learn to write functional sentences that just tell a story.
Great. Well, thank you again so much for being here, letting me take your time, and I'll see you guys on the other side.
My pleasure. Thank you.
As always, thank you so much for listening to Ink and Worm on Radio Free Brooklyn. I hope you enjoyed the show. If you have any questions or comments, I'm going old school. Email me, inkandworm, all spelled out, all lowercase, @gmail.com. And thanks for listening to Radio Free Brooklyn. I hope you enjoy the rest of your day, and I will leave you with a word, take it or leave it. Mithridates. Bitter sweet.
you.